nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so good morning. This is the start of lecture two in the ME 597 Physics 570 dual offered course on fundamentals of atomic force microscopy. What we're, of course, doing is we're trying to understand how a scanning tunneling microscope works as a way to introduce atomic force microscopy. And the general theme of this lecture is that if you want to understand how a scanning tunneling microscope works, you have to first understand something about the electron states that are present in solids, because it's the electrons that are tunneling from a tip to a substrate. So in this lecture, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the Kronig-Penig model of electrons in solids. From the Kronig-Penig model, we're going to talk a little bit about block functions and what they mean. And we're going to derive some interesting facts about density of states in solids that will become important when we're trying to understand how a scanning tunneling microscope works. Once we've accomplished these three things, we'll end our quick review of electrons in solids, and we'll then launch into an introduction of why you need a scanning probe microscope. So that's the overall plan of the lecture. So if you attended the last lecture, you'll remember that we discussed two simplified models for electrons in solid. One was a free electron model. The other was a nearly free electron model. The nearly free electron model was developed to allow a better description of electron states in periodic solids. And the one new thing that the nearly free electron model introduced was the presence of energy gaps in the allowed E versus K curves for electrons in a periodic one-dimensional solid. Today, we'd like to talk a little bit more about a historically very important model called the Kronig-Penig model. We're again going to confine our attention to a one-dimensional periodic crystal, and we're going to ask what are the nature of the wave functions that develop when you start to approximate the electrostatic potential energy by a series of square well barriers that I've got drawn in this particular slide. So these square well barriers are going to have a width B. They're going to be separated one from another by a distance A. We're going to say that there are capital N of these square wells in a lattice of length N. And the total length of that lattice is just going to be the number of cells N times the distance A plus B, as I've indicated. Again, we want to note that the potential U of X, the electrostatic potential energy U of X, is periodic in displacement by quantity A plus B, or also by any integer numbers of displacements given by A plus B. So this could be like one model for the Kronig-Penig model. This could be one model. Another model is a delta function model. This delta function model is introduced in this particular diagram. It arises logically from the previous model. Once again, the atom cores are separated by a distance A. Every time X is equal to an integer multiple of N times A, we get a spike in the electrostatic potential energy. The height of that spike is given by U0. And the form of the electrostatic potential energy as a function of X is represented by this sum over all these delta functions, X minus NA, with an argument of X minus NA as shown by the equation. Note once again that the periodic potential, note once again that the electrostatic potential energy is periodic in the lattice constant A. That's a unifying theme of all these particular models that we introduce. You can continue on with this discussion. You can list models C, D, so on and so forth. They all have similar characteristics to the ones that I've just drawn, but you quickly come to the question, are there any unifying principles that we can discuss that may shed light on the nature of the electron wave functions that result when you put them into these one-dimensional periodic potentials? And the answer to that question is yes, there are a few unifying principles. The principles come from mathematical study of Schrödinger's equation. It turns out that when U of X is periodic, the resulting Schrödinger equation belongs to a class of differential equations known as Hill's equation. And mathematicians have known for a long time that solutions to Hill's equation must obey a theorem proposed by Fouquet. This theorem is also in condensed matter physics known as Bloch's theorem. And this theorem states that solutions for the electron wave function, when the electrostatic potential energy is periodic with the periodicity given by the lattice constant A, right, the form of the solutions has to be the product of two functions. One function is referred to as small uk of x, in this case. The second function is this plane wave like function or plane wave-like term e to the ikx that's shown on this particular slide. So this is a consequence just strictly of the periodicity of U of X that's involved in Schrödinger's equation. It's a very general theorem. It's very powerful. And the question, of course, is how do you use it to understand more about the electron wave functions that develop when you put electrons into this one-dimensional lattice that's periodic in A. So one thing that you quickly learn is that these functions U sub K of X, these functions are referred to as Bloch wave functions. These Bloch wave functions must have the same periodicity of the lattice that you impose in the problem. And this U of K, this function U of K, also depends on this parameter K, which is the wave vector of the electron that's characteristic of the plane wave part of this solution, which is designated by e to the ikx. So these Bloch functions U sub K, they are somehow intrinsically linked with the plane wave type wave functions e to the ikx. And of course, it's our job to try to explain that linkage in the next few slides. First of all, what would this wave function, what would the appearance of this wave function be if you could plot it out? Let me say that this Bloch's theorem is valid no matter what the form of the periodic potential is. The solutions must have certain properties that satisfy these very, very general conditions. And it's useful to consider this U of K as a correction factor that generates solutions for periodic potentials that you might pose that start with this trivial e to the ikx plane wave solution. So the uk of x, the Bloch functions, are actually related to atomic wave functions in the lattice, and they correct the plane wave e to the ikx solutions that are valid for, let's say, the free electron model. And the way you're going to distinguish the different solutions that are allowed by Schrödinger's equation, because there could be many solutions to this problem, each solution would have a different energy, the way you're going to distinguish these different solutions is by this wave vector K, which is going to serve as an index to label the different solutions to Schrödinger's equation for this completely general periodic electrostatic potential energy that we've discussed Okay. What does a plot of the wave function look like? This is an example that I got from some of the very early work done by Slater back in the 1930s. What you see here is you see a plot of the solutions to Schrödinger's equation for a one-dimensional periodic lattice. The solutions are indicate both the plane wave solution, e to the ikx, that's indicated by the dashed line. They also, I also try to illustrate in this diagram the block functions u sub k of x, which are these rapidly varying functions that result whenever the wave function coincides with an atom in the lattice. And the atom in the lattice is, of course, spaced periodically by this distance A. Okay, so this is the type of wave function that you're going to expect when you multiply these block functions by the plane waves, e to the ikx. And under these circumstances, it's interesting to ask, what is the relationship now that develops between the allowed energy states of the electrons in this one-dimensional solid and the wave vector k that specifies the solutions to Schrödinger's equation for a particular energy? So that's the question. What is the relationship between E and K now that we have a little bit more complicated, a little bit more realistic approximation for the electrostatic potential energy that's specified by this Kronig-Penney model? So you can answer this question in a number of ways. You can look in the textbooks and you'll find different discussions. One discussion I present here is based on the translational symmetry of U of X, right? You argue that because the lattice of atoms is translationally symmetric, as long as you step forward in the lattice by an integer number of lattice points A, you would expect that the electron has the same probability to exist at equivalent points in the lattice, right? This just follows again from the periodicity. And what this means is, this means that, for instance, the wave function at x plus a should somehow be related to the wave function at x, in the sense that the probability of finding the electron at x plus a should be equal to the probability of finding the electron at wave function at position x. And this can be specified in a mathematical way by saying that the amplitude of the wave function squared at x plus ma has to be equal to the magnitude of the wave function squared at x, where m is an integer equal to 1, 2, 3, all the way up to capital N, which is the number of atoms in this one-dimensional lattice. So this very simple relationship means that you can write the wave function at x plus a in terms of the wave function at x by multiplying the wave function at x by some number j. J is an operator. It has to be determined. And it follows, right, that J translates the electron wave function from x to x plus a. It follows that if you move down the lattice by, let's say, m times a, by a distance m times a, then the wave function at x plus ma should be equal to, in some way, the wave function at x by just reapplying this operator J m times. Right, so you end up with this equation: J sub m is equal to J sub m times the wave function at psi of x gives you the wave function psi at x plus ma. Right, this is the fundamental equation that we must solve in order to understand how the symmetry of the lattice reflects back into the allowed wave function psi that exists in that lattice. So what we say is then, for n cells in a one-dimensional crystal, we have this relationship that j raised to the nth power times the wave function at x has to equal the wave function at x plus na. And we have to ask ourselves, what are the implications for this operator J such that these various conditions are uniquely satisfied, right? That's the question. Well, the implication is, if you sit down and think about it, the implication is that J must, of course, equal unity. That's the only way it can happen. And since there are n lattice sites in the one-dimensional crystal, J must be one of the n roots of unity, right? That means that J has a very particular form. In particular, that form can be written as e to the 2 pi I times the ratio of m over n, where m is an integer that ranges between 1 and n. And this just simply means that the wave function at psi of x multiplied by this e to the I 2 pi I m over n, right? That allows you to then translate the wave function in space to another position in the lattice. And it indicates that the main result of this translation through an integer number of lattice constants is just a change in the phase of the wave function by this factor 2 pi I times the ratio of m over n. Okay? So you can understand this very nicely in terms of a simple geometric diagram. But what we're really interested in is following through on the consequences of this very simple observation. And within the context of the block theorem that we've just discussed, what we can say is that the translational requirements for the electron wave function psi can be met if we write the wave function psi as a product of two terms. The first term is this u sub m of x. U sub m is now a block function that has the same periodicity as the electrostatic potential energy that we're considering. And the plane wave solution of the Schrödinger's equation can now be written in a very special way. It can be written as 2 pi I times the ratio of m divided by Na, where Na is the total length of the crystal. So depending on which value of m we choose, again, m ranges from 1 to n, depending on which value of m that we choose, we have different quantities u sub m. And I tried to indicate that by coloring in index m in red to indicate that there is a u sub m that's linked to every m that appears in the plane wave-like solution of the block function psi of x. Okay? And so by specifying m, we specify basically how many complete cycles this exponential must complete in a distance L. And this is something you can sit down and work out yourself, that for wave functions of the form e to the 2 pi I times the ratio of m over Na times x, for wave functions of that form, right, you can convince yourself that m goes through, that function goes through m complete cycles as x goes from 0 to Na, the length of the crystal. So this quantity m is telling us how many times the plane wave part of this solution oscillates as we go through the entire length of the crystal. That's the physical significance of the quantity. So it's all we have to do now is we have to rewrite this ratio of integers m over n with 2 pi and a written in there. We have to rewrite that in terms of a wave vector k, and it then follows that Bloch's function psi of x is related to Bloch function u sub k of x times a plane wave function e to the I k x, where now the quantity k is linked one to another, and I've tried to indicate that by labeling each value of k in red. So that linkage between k and u of k and e to the ikx, that linkage just comes from the linkage of m that's indicated in the top part of this slide. There's nothing magical about it. It's just a bookkeeping thing that has to be kept track of in a coherent and consistent way. So there are a few consequences of this theorem, right? and in particular the effect of a translation by an integer m times a can be represented in a very straightforward fashion, as I've shown. And by specifying the translation that you want to make through the lattice, you uniquely define this wave vector k, right? So if you tell me how many lattice vectors m you want to translate through, I can immediately tell you what the k vector is that will satisfy that particular translation. And also, the other thing that's going to be important when we start to talk about scanning tunneling microscopy is that if you evaluate this wave function at x equal to zero, well, that plane wave solution, e to the ikx, that's going to equal unity. And the wave function at x equals zero is just going to simply be this block function u sub k evaluated at zero for a particular energy e that we might be interested in. So you're going to have to remember that fact, because that's going to come back and we'll discuss that in more detail. This is another way of saying the same thing. I won't go through it in a whole lot of detail. You can certainly read it on your own. The end result is shown in the last line of this slide. What you end up with is the same definition for the wave vector k. And this argument is based on a periodic boundary condition, and just insists that the wave function at x equals the wave function at x plus l. And with that simple requirement, you end up with the same specification for the wave vector k in terms of a ratio of integers m and n multiplied by this parameter 2 pi over a. So either way, you get the same result. The consequence of this is, right, the consequence of this is that k is now discrete. It's no longer continuous. And what I try to do is I try to indicate the labeling scheme for this wave vector k that these electrons can now have. I tried to indicate that in the bottom part of this slide, where this red line indicates all possible values of k. The black dots on that red line indicate the values of k that are allowed for the different integer values of m. So I let m run through integer values from 1 all the way up to n, and the appropriate k values for each selection, for each choice of m, those particular k values are indicated either above or below the dots. And values of k in between those dots are no longer allowed in this model, this Kronig-Penney model for electrons in a periodic lattice. Notice that the separation between k, which I refer to as delta k in this slide, that quantity delta k is just 2 pi divided by the length of the crystal L. Length of the crystal is just the number of atoms n times the separation between them a. So once you specify the length of the crystal, that tells you the separation between the k values. And once you specify the number of atoms in the crystal, that allows you to specify the ranges of m that can be used in a particular problem. Once you know the ranges of m, then you uniquely specify all the particular values of k that exist. Okay? So, if you've heard this argument before, if you've taken a solid-state physics class, usually the argument is drawn out and more details are put in than I give in this introductory lecture. But the bottom line, the thing that you have to realize is that if the k values of the electrons are now discrete, right, and the energy E that solves Schrödinger's equation depends on k, k is discrete and quantized, then the energy values E must also be discrete and quantized. And so this idea of having a continuous value of allowed energies E that comes out of the free electron model, that's no longer applicable. The allowed energies for electrons in this one-dimensional periodic potential will be quantized in ways that we'll discuss in the next few slides. So the next logical topic is to apply these concepts to, let's say, this delta function Kronig-Penney model. This is a particularly easy problem to solve, and it it gives you some insight into the types of wave functions that can exist in a periodic lattice. The argument is only carried out for one dimension, but the results that we're going to learn carry over into three dimensions, and I'll try to make that clear as we proceed through the lecture. So the first thing to make a start on this, I have to ask you to imagine a periodic potential barrier or periodic potential, electrostatic potential set up is indicated by these periodic delta functions. Each delta function is a height u0. The delta functions are separated by a distance a, and I'm going to specify two points on this infinitely long lattice. One point is just to the left of a delta function, and that's referred to as point one. And that point one is going to have a wave function psi one of x. I'm going to specify a point just to the other side of that delta function. That's point two. And there's going to be a wave function psi 2 of x prime at that particular point. So x and x prime are separated by a small distance on either side from one of these delta function wells. Doesn't matter which delta function well it is, they're all equivalent because the whole thing is periodic. And to solve Schrödinger's equation for this periodic potential, what we're going to do is we're going to require that the wave function at psi 1 of x is going to match the wave function at psi 2 x prime in the limit when x approaches x prime. So as these two points get closer and closer to one another, we're going to require that the two wave functions match. And we're also going to require that the derivative of the wave functions are also continuous in the limit when the two points 1 and 2 get very close to one another. If you sit down and sort out these two boundary conditions, it turns out you can derive an equation. The equation that you can derive is indicated in this yellow box. And this equation is useful because it allows you to specify the allowed k's in terms of the energies E that the electrons can have when you put them in this periodic potential wells that we've got drawn. So this quantity in the yellow box is often referred to as the energy functional, and it's an interesting equation that has to be worked out. On the left-hand side, you'll see that you have the cosine of allowed k values, k times the lattice constant A. On the right-hand side, you can see that you've got a more complicated function that depends on two parameters. The two parameters that it depends on are this parameter alpha, where alpha is nothing more than 2 times the mass of an electron times the energy E divided by h bar squared, square root of that quantity. And you've also got this parameter P, which basically specifies the limit of the product of the width of the well times the height of the well. So realistically, we treat P as an adjustable parameter. We pick a value of P, and that specifies a well width and a well height through this particular equation that defines P. And the left-hand side, because there's an equal side, right? There's an equal sign in this equation. The left-hand side has to equal the right-hand side. It's not obvious that it does. But one thing you can say is that the function on the left-hand side is confined to the range of minus 1 to plus 1, simply because it's a cosine function. And so that means that there's going to be only certain values of alpha for a given A. There's only going to be certain values of alpha and P on the right-hand side of the equation that will cause the right-hand side of the equation to be to lie between the plus one, minus one limits specified by the left-hand side of the equation. And so that's how you solve this problem. This is how you get the relationship between E and K, right? And I try to illustrate that by plotting out this energy function now for a particular value of P. I think the value of P I used here was 1.6, if my memory serves me correctly. So on the x-axis, I plot the quantity K times A. That quantity K times A is just the argument of this cosine function, right? And the cosine function has to oscillate between minus 1 and 1. That's indicated by the two parallel green lines in this chart. The energy function now, the right-hand side of that equation is given by the red line in this diagram. So as I vary K times A, I can plot out the right-hand side of the equation, and there are only going to be allowed solutions for the energy versus K for the energy and K of the electron. There's only going to be allowed solutions when the red line falls between the two parallel green lines. When the red line is either above plus one or below minus one, there will be no real solutions to that equation. That means that there are no energy states allowed that propagate throughout the entire crystal. And there will, as a result, there will be energy gaps in the E versus K curves specified by these ranges of parameters where the energy function now, the red curve, is greater or less than a 1 or minus 1. Okay? There's only real solutions for the values of the red curve that are bounded between the two green lines in this particular diagram. So what are the consequences of this? Right? The consequences of this are that when you work it all out, it turns out you plot the allowed energies versus the allowed K vectors, right? You find out that there are allowed solutions that are real, and then these real solutions, these range of real solutions, are separated by an energy gap indicated by that gray box in this diagram. In that gray box, there are solutions to Schrödinger's equation, but those solutions are imaginary, and so they don't propagate through the lattice. They tend to, that's where you get the concept of surface states, right? The surface states in a crystal are those solutions for imaginary K. The other thing you'll note from this diagram is that now the energy is no longer single-valued with K. For a particular value of K, you can have two allowed energy states. And of course, these two allowed energy states, we refer to those as electrons in different energy bands of the crystal. So the blue curve represents the E versus K curve for electrons in the first band of the crystal. The red curve indicates the E versus K curve for electrons in the second band of the crystal. Right? The energy gaps appear just like they did in the nearly free electron model, so that's nothing new. That's not a surprise. And clearly the E versus K curves are no longer free electron-like. These E versus K curves are nowhere close to the free electron parabolas that we saw towards the end of the previous lecture. So those are the three new things that this delta function Kronig-Penney model introduces. There are all consequences of of the nature of the electron states that exist in this one-dimensional periodic solid. And it's very important to understand these modifications to the E versus K curves, especially because it's going to relate to how electrons can tunnel from a tip into a substrate, right? The way electrons tunnel from a tip to a substrate is going to be related in some way to the allowed energy states that the electron can have when it's both in the tip and when it's in the substrate. So again, that's why we're going through all this, to try to give you some insight into what's actually going on. You can compare the allowed energy states versus K for the Kronig-Penney model. You can compare that to the free electron model. So the allowed E versus K for a free electron model, that's indicated by the dashed lines in this particular diagram. The allowed E versus K in the delta function Kronig-Penney model is indicated by the solid lines, and you can see that energy gaps open up whenever K is equal to plus minus pi over A. You can see that the E versus K curves deviate significantly from those predicted by the free electron model. And you can see in this particular diagram that the first three bands of the allowed energy states are plotted. So there's band one at the bottom, band two is at the middle, band three is at the top. Each of those bands are separated one from another by forbidden ranges of energies that constitute the energy gaps in this crystal. Now, you can look at this in a little bit more detail. There's a really good website that's available. I list the address of that particular website. And what you can do in this website is you can specify the height of these potential barriers, V. You can specify the width of the potential barriers, W. And you can specify the energy of the electrons in that particular periodic electrostatic potential energy well. And that's specified by the parameter E. All three of these parameters can be controlled by sliders, so it's very easy to adjust the sliders to modify the shape of the potential barrier and to select out different energies of electron states in that barrier. What you'll find is particular applet of this particular website just has a whole host of information that you can gain from it. I just represent one simulation that I ran. I picked the energy of the electron state indicated by that green line in the middle part of this slide. I picked that energy state to be roughly in the middle of the potential barriers that were of height V, specified by about 16 electron volts. This applet gives you the wave functions. It gives you the real part of the wave function in red. It gives you the imaginary part of the wave function in blue. And then it also plots psi star in orange. It's kind of hard for you to see psi star on this slide, but I think if you look at the PDF slides that are accompanying this lecture, I think it'll be a little bit more obvious. In addition to plotting the wave functions, the real and imaginary parts of the wave functions, there's also a little inset that allows you to look at the nature of the block functions that are specified over the unit cell of this particular crystal. That's indicated by the middle panel in this slide. And then lastly, at the far right bottom of this panel, you can see where the energy E lies with respect to the E of K curves that are appropriate for the particular parameters that you've chosen for V and the width W. So I think the best way to learn more about these wave functions is to play around with this applet. Let me just say that the large sinusoidal-like variation of the real and imaginary part of the wave function, that's driven by the e to the ikx, the plane wave solution of the wave function. And then if you'll note, there's a slight modulation of the wave function, little bumps that appear periodically separated by a distance a on that sinusoidal-like variation. Those little periodic bumps are the block function's use of k that must be present in order to satisfy Schrödinger's equation. If you want to emphasize those functions' use of k, what you should do is you should lower the energy E, make the energy lowered to the bottom of the potential wells. When you'll do that, you'll see that the plane wave solutions are decorated with sharp features that are just reflections of this block function use of K of X that we've been discussing. If you want to de-emphasize the block functions, you want to make the wave function solutions more free electron-like, you want to raise the energy E above the tops of those potential wells. If you do that, you'll find that the real and imaginary parts of the wave functions look much more sinusoidal, much more free electron-like than they do even in this particular diagram. You'll also see, if you look at this carefully and you systematically go through some simulations, you'll see that this idea that the periodicity of the wave function repeats after a distance A, that's reflected in this quantity psi-psi star. So you'll also find out that psi-psi star is perfectly periodic across this crystal of length L. In this case, there's 20 atoms in the crystal. You'll also find that as you adjust the energy E of those electrons by sliding the green line up and down, you will find that there are standing waves that are set up. These standing waves are the result of this back reflection of the electrons from this periodic potential. These standing waves are bounded by regions of energy where no electron states are allowed to propagate in the crystal. And, of course, those regions in energy are indicated by the gap that appears, in this case, between the first and the second band, as indicated in that dispersion curve on the bottom right. So there's a wealth of information that you can extract from these simulations if you just go and sit down and work your way through them. You'll improve your knowledge of wave functions in one-dimensional solids immensely. So I hope you all have time to take a look at this simulation from your own computer. So there's just a few notes. If you have trouble getting this lecture in color, right, these notes just tell you what the different colors represent and provide a sort of a verbal guideline to a lot of the things that I just got finished saying. The last topic we have to cover before we end this review is, finally, after you go through all this, where are the electrons in that crystal? Okay. And the answer to that question depends on where you want to measure the electrons. Do you want to measure the position of the electrons? Do you want to know where the electronic charge, how the electronic charge is distributed? Or do you want to know what energy the electrons are more likely to reside in? Okay. So if you're interested in the position of the electrons, then you just have to take the wave function for a particular energy, take its complex conjugate, multiply those two quantities together, specify a distance delta x along that crystal, and the product of psi times psi star times delta x, whatever that number is, that will tell you what the probability is that the electron is at that particular value x. If you're interested in the charge of the electron and how the charge in the electron is distributed, you have to first calculate the position, the probability that the electron is in a particular position, then you have to multiply that by the electronic charge minus E. So those two things are reasonably straightforward, and it's an extension of what we discussed in the first part of the first lecture. The new twist is the electrons are no longer distributed uniformly in energy, right? It turns out because there are now states that are allowed, there are energy states that are allowed, there are energy states that are forbidden, there's now a distribution in energy of where those electrons are, and that distribution in energy means that we have to define a density of electron states. We have to be able to specify at what energy we have the highest probability of finding an electron. And again, this is going to be important when we start to talk about how electrons tunnel from a tip into a substrate. It turns out that tunneling current between the tip and the substrate is largely governed by the local density of states that the tip selects out when it's positioned at a particular point above a metal. So the argument, again, if you've had a introductory course in solid-state physics, this argument is, you've probably seen it many times, but for those of you that haven't had this introductory course in solid-state physics, let me say that the number of electrons or the number of particles per unit volume with an energy between E and dE, that quantity can be represented by this thing called N of E in the blue box on the left side of this slide. And this quantity N of E is related to the number of energy states per unit volume in the energy interval, delta E. That's this quantity G of E. We have to also specify whether the states are filled or empty, and that's done with the Fermi-Dirac probability distribution function F of E. And so if you tell me the density, the number density of energy states at a particular energy interval delta E, and if you tell me the probability that those states are occupied, specified by F of E, you multiply those two things together, and what we get is this number of particles per unit volume with energy between E and E plus delta E. So this is a number. This is just basically counting the number of electrons that are there. If you want to calculate a density of states, then what you have to do is you have to calculate the difference in the number density divided by an energy interval delta E, and you have to take the limit as that energy interval delta E goes to zero. So I've indicated that in the bottom part of the slide enclosed in the yellow box. This quantity rho of E is often referred to as the density of electron states, and it's nothing more than the derivative of dN dE evaluated at a particular value of energy E. And that will tell you, if you go through this prescription, that will tell you how many electron states there actually are at a particular energy E in a crystalline solid that you may be interested in. So this is a three-dimensional discussion. If you're interested in two dimensions, then everywhere you see the word volume, you have to replace the word volume by area. If you're interested in a one-dimensional discussion, then everywhere you see the word volume, you have to replace the word volume by length. So these definitions, I think, scale reasonably well to different dimensions. You just have to know whether you're dealing with volumes, areas, or lengths. And this definition, I think, applies to all three cases. So our discussion up till now has mostly been for one-dimensional solid. So that means that we're going to be talking about the number of electrons at a particular energy that lie in a crystalline solid of one dimension with n unit cells. That's the case that we're most interested in. So the issue is, how do you calculate these quantities? And the answer is, you just have to simply go back to basics, right? The basics are, if you're given the energy versus K relationship, the E versus K, that's calculated using some model. In one dimension, we're using a Kroning-Penning model. So there's a certain shape to this E versus K curve. And if you look very carefully at a certain segment of that E versus K curve, you'll recall that it's made up of quantized K vectors. Each quantized K vector is indicated by a black dot on that little panel to the right of this slide. Those black dots are separated by this separation distance delta K equal to 2 pi divided by the length of the one-dimensional solid we're interested in. And so for an interval capital delta K, right, for an interval capital delta K, we just have to count up the number of allowed K vectors in that particular interval range. And that then tells us the number of states that exist at a particular energy E, at a particular energy between E and E plus delta E. That's the quantity that we're trying to calculate. So I go through the calculation in the first line of algebra in this slide. You basically have to divide the script delta K into the capital delta K length interval. That'll tell you how many allowed states are in that range. I multiply by a factor 2 to take into account the spins of the electrons. And I do some conversion of units there. And I eventually end up with an expression that says that the number of states that exist in an energy range delta E is nothing more than the length divided by pi times the change in the K vector with the change in the E vector. Okay? That's the number of states in that energy, number of allowed states at energy E, between energy E and E plus delta E. And then, of course, as you take the limit as delta E goes to zero, that goes to a derivative, and that derivative is then, by definition, the density of states, rho of E, that's defined in the last slide, last line of this slide. So we're almost at the end. Okay, I think we've basically said everything that's important. The problem is, I guess the summary statement of the problem is, if we have a periodic lattice with an electrostatic potential energy indicated by a sequence of these delta functions, and we start to pour electrons into that one-dimensional solid, where in energy do those electrons go? And the answer to that question is, you have to calculate the density of electron states for that particular system. The density of electron states requires you to know how the energy depends on the K vector. And in particular, you've got to know how the derivative of the energy depends on the K vector in order to calculate the density of states. So a lot of these simulation programs on Purdue's NanoHub allow you to do these calculations very quickly. You don't have to work out all the details. Those have all been sorted out for you. And in particular, what I show is I show, let's say, the allowed E versus K curves for delta function Kronig-Penning model. The particular parameter P that I've selected for this model is 1.65. I plot the first two bands. The first band is in blue. The second band is in red. And if you just follow the prescription in the yellow box, take the derivative of the energy with respect to K, take the reciprocal of that, multiply it by 1 over pi, right? You can go from the energy bands to the density of states, which is plotted on the right-hand side of this particular slide. So you can see that the electron density of states in this particular model has some interesting characteristics. First of all, the electron density of states goes to zero, precisely where there's an energy gap between the first and the second band. So that's the first thing that you pick off. The second thing that you notice is that the electron density of states has peaks associated with it. Those peaks tend to be located at the extremum, the lower and the upper levels of the bands. Right? And the reason for that is that's where the energy bands flatten out. When the energy bands flatten out, that equation in the yellow box gets to be a very large number because the slope goes to zero. So you can see the bands at the edges of the bands, there tend to be large spikes in the electron density of states. The other thing that you have to realize is that these are allowed states. They do not tell you which states are occupied and which states are unoccupied. To answer that question, you have to put in the Fermi-Dirac distribution function. And so, for instance, that Fermi-Dirac distribution function will then tell you where in this energy spectrum the filled states are, where the empty states are. And in this particular diagram, I've just indicated that schematically. It's a purely schematic representation. I've indicated by this dashed line. All the states below that dashed line are filled. All the states above that dashed line are empty, okay? And we're pretending that the temperature of the solid is low enough that the spread between the filled and the empty states is not important in this discussion. So that's an example of the density of states in one dimension. Go from the Kronig-Penning model to the density of states in a very simple way, and you can do this on a NanoHub. You just, the whole first homework assignment has a problem that allows you to direct you through this calculation of E versus K to the density of states, right, to try and reinforce these ideas. The question arises, how is things modified in three dimensions? And the answer is it's a lot more complicated, but a lot of the salient features that we've discussed come through. So I just went to the literature, found a plot of E versus K for three dimensions. It turns out this is a plot of E versus K for lead selenide. The x-axis labels different points in K-space. Now, K-space is no longer one-dimensional. It's got three dimensions. And these three dimensions are represented by these symbols that are located along the bottom of the x-axis. The allowed energy states are indicated along the y-axis. They range from minus 10 eV to plus 10 eV. You can see the electron energy bands that are plotted. They're really rather complicated. And then on the right-hand side of the graph in the blue, you can see the resulting calculation of the three-dimensional density of states that results from these particular energy bands. You can, in fact, see that there are at least two well-defined ranges of energies. Those two well-defined ranges of energy I've labeled as band 1 and band 2. As you get up to higher energies, you can see that there's so many bands and they overlap, it starts to get very hard to distinguish which is band 3 from which is band 4. And then I've also tried to make the case that every time you've got a peak in the density of states, so every time you've got a spike in the blue curve, which shows up at these, I've tried to indicate a few of them by these parallel dashed lines, right? If you trace that through, you'll find out that those peaks in the density of states always line up with regions of the E versus K curve, which are reasonably flat. Okay, which are reasonably flat. They have very small slopes. So whenever the E versus K curves have a small slope, you end up with a big density of states, as indicated in this particular diagram. And then lastly, there's some standard results that you can find in the literature. I just put this slide up. This is for a free electron case, right? Free electron case in 1, 2, and 3 dimensions. So it's, you tell me either you're interested in one dimension, in which case I'll tell you what the length of the crystal is. If you tell me you're interested in two-dimensional electron gas, then the appropriate quantity is the area A. If you're interested in three dimensions, then the appropriate volume V is L cubed. And the slide just summarizes the number density of electrons as a function of energy, and then it also gives you the density of electron states in the three dimensions for a line, an area, and a volume. These calculations are only good for free electrons, right, a very limited model. They can't be applied to, let's say, a Kronig-Penning model in a straightforward way. Kronig-Penning model, you actually have to go calculate the E versus K's curves. You have to take the derivatives, and you have to get the density of states in that particular way. So that marks the end of our review. What we've done is we've tried to summarize very quickly some of the fundamental ideas behind quantum mechanics, and then we've tried to apply those ideas to understanding electron states in solids, because we're going to need to know more about those electron states in solids when we start to talk about the scanning tunneling microscope. For those of you that have had a course in condensed matter physics, pretty much everything I've said here is just by way of review of things that you've probably spent weeks discussing in the lecture room. For those of you that may not have had the opportunity to take a solid-state physics course, what I've tried to do is I've tried to pick out some of the essential features that you need to know in order to understand at least the basics of how a scanning tunneling microscope works. So that's the end of the review, and now we're going to move on and start to discuss a little bit of the motivation behind the invention of the scanning tunneling microscope.